Hi, I'm Stephanie Potter with Political Perspectives here on KBOO Portland, and my guest is Paul Pearson, who with Jacob Hacker first published Off-Center, The Republican Revolution and the Erosion of American Democracy. Their most recent book is called Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class. Paul Pearson is noted for his research on comparative public policy and the political economy, also the welfare state and American political development. Pearson is also a native of Eugene, Oregon, where both his parents taught at the University of Oregon. Pearson himself taught at Harvard University from 1989 to 2004, when he moved to University of California, Berkeley, and where he is presently a professor of political science and the Avis Saint Chair in Public Policy. First of all, Paul, I just want to say welcome to KBOO.
Thanks for having me on, Stephanie.
Great. Basically, there's this issue that the rich have just gotten a lot richer, and I think almost everybody knows that over the past few decades. And most Americans have not gotten richer. And the book just had incredible graphs kind of describing the situation, and the statistics were astounding. I would sort of like you to go into that, describe some of the statistics that you think are most important.
Well, the statistics are really remarkable, I think. But in some ways, maybe it's better to start with just an image of what we're talking about. Because when people think about rising inequality, often the way they think about it is if you imagine a ladder, you know, just imagine it all stretching out and the rungs getting further apart from each other. But a better way to think of what's happened in the United States would be if you imagine all the rungs in the ladder staying the same except for the very top one or the very top two, and those just shooting off into space. Because it's not just that inequality has grown, but it's really just incredible growth in the distance between the very well-to-do and everyone else. And we sometimes think about the top 10%, but when you talk about what's happened in the United States, it makes a lot more sense to focus on the top 1% or even smaller groups within the top 1%. So it's been a very concentrated gain in income. And maybe just to put a single statistic in there, a group to focus on would be the top 10th of 1%. So one out of every 1,000 families in the U.S. And these are families that now average incomes of about $7 million a year. But they've seen their share of income essentially quadruple in the last three decades, going from less than three out of every $100 earned in the United States to over 10 of every $100 earned in the United States. So it's just an astonishing shift. And again, not say from the poor to the upper middle class, but really from everyone to a very concentrated group at the top.
Which we might call the super rich, something like that.
Yeah.
And this isn't happening to the same extent in other countries, I noticed in your statistics, in your graphs.
Well, that I think is both a striking development and something that we see as an important clue to understanding what's been going on. There has been some growth of inequality in most of the world's wealthiest democracies. But what we call this sort of winner-take-all outcome is very, very unusual in international perspective. You see some of these trends in Great Britain, but really much less anywhere else among the developed economies. The U.S. really stands out.
And so what kind of countries are we beginning to resemble then?
Again, a way to picture what's happened. You could think of the U.S. 30 years ago as being clustered with a group of countries that we think of as sort of the affluent democracies, Western Europe, Canada, Japan, Australia, which were countries that had very successful economies and, you know, fairly high rates of inequality, but also fairly broad-based increases in economic well-being across the population as a whole. And over the last 30 years, we've been drifting away from that cluster towards a different cluster, which we call the cluster of economic oligarchies. Think of some of the Latin American countries like Brazil or Mexico or Russia today, where economic gains are much more concentrated within a narrow circle of winners. We haven't gotten quite to that point yet in the U.S., but it is clearly the direction that we're moving. And as I said before, it's not as if the whole cluster of rich democracies is moving in that direction. We're actually making a transit away from the European-Canadian cluster towards this very different grouping.
pretty amazing. And what do you say then to those who argue that, well, so what? I mean, some of your graphs show that the poor people, they were still going up a little bit, even though the rich are going up a whole lot. And so the rich are going up a whole lot, so what? I mean, what's the real problem with that?
Well, I think there are a couple of things to say about that, and it is an argument that we often hear when we talk about this book. Who cares if more of the gains are going to those at the top as long as that rising tide is lifting all boats? And, of course, the first part of the answer to that is that it's not lifting all boats. That's the other really dramatic change in the economy that's taken place over the last 30 years is that middle-class families, so not just the poor, but the middle class and even what we might think of as the upper middle class, has really struggled just to sustain its standard of living. The fruits of economic growth have gone overwhelmingly towards those at the top. So hidden behind this is a real struggle for the middle class. We describe it in the book as a shift away from the economy that existed from, say, World War II to the mid-1970s, which we describe as broadland. And then we borrow a term from the journalist Robert Frank, who describes contemporary America more as being Richistan. You know, we've moved from broadland to Richistan, and the middle class, which saw its income and standard of living grow rapidly during those 30 years of broadland, has seen almost no income growth in the period since then. And what little growth that they have seen is mostly because families are putting in more hours of paid work as women have moved into the paid labor force increasingly. So people have had to run faster and faster just to hold even, while the fruits of economic growth have gone overwhelmingly to those at the top. But then the other thing to say is it's not just that the tide's only been rising for some people and it's not rising for the broad mass of the population, but there are a lot of unhealthy things about that extreme concentration of economic power. And one of the central arguments in our book is that it's hard to keep that kind of economic revolution from tainting the political system as well. That's why the title of the book is actually Winner Take All Politics, because Washington has been transformed by this economic revolution. I mean, there's a kind of vicious circle in which Washington has helped to bring about many of these changes that have increased economic inequality. And then at the same time, as the inequality grows, that further changes the complexion of American democracy, and we argue makes it much less responsive to the needs of the middle class.
Well, and that's actually what you said. You said the title of the book has to do with winner-take-all politics, and I'd like to get into why is it so top-heavy. You talk about that it's not to do with education so much, it's not to do with globalization so much, not all these technical innovations that have happened, but it's really politics. And could you talk a little more about that?
Right, so the standard story up until a few years ago, and still in many circles, the standard story was, yes, inequality is growing in the United States, but it's basically a result of globalization and technological developments, which have advantaged the highly educated. So George W. Bush's Treasury Secretary, former Goldman Sachs head, Henry Paulson, when he talked about inequality before the big crash of the economy, he acknowledged that inequality was an issue, but he also said, well, it's just an economic reality, and there's no point in blaming any political party. And that was obviously, you know, he wanted to make sure that nobody blamed Republicans, but there was a pretty broad consensus, I think, among economists in saying this is really about what they called skill-biased technological change that has meant that the educated have gained at the expense of the non-educated. And we push back hard against that argument in the book, which we think is both inaccurate and leads to a kind of complacency about all this that just says, well, it's inevitable, it's just a result of the way in which the world has changed, and there's not much that anybody can really do about it. But there are a couple obvious problems. One is that, as we say, the gains have been incredibly concentrated. So it's not as if everybody with a college education or everybody with a post-college education is benefiting at the expense of those who are less educated. The gains have been much, much more concentrated than that. Most highly educated Americans have been on the losing side of this transformation. So that argument can't really explain the incredible top-heaviness of the shift in income. And then, of course, the other point that I mentioned earlier is, if it were really a matter of technological change and globalization, then we would expect to see the same thing happening in Germany and Japan and Canada, all of which are countries that are using the same technology in their economies that we are, and all of which are actually more exposed to the global economy than the United States is. And yet you don't see those same kind of trends. So we don't think that these arguments can really explain what's happened to income distribution in the U.S.
I'd like to just pause here and let listeners know you're listening to KBOO Portland, Political Perspectives. I'm Stephanie Potter, and I'm speaking with Paul Pearson, who co-authored Winner Take All Politics. And as the book goes on, it talks about the politics being both a combination of what you call policy and what you call drift. And could you just talk about how that's working?
Sure. So we sort of lay out this whole thing as a mystery with multiple chapters, where in the early part of the book we explain this astonishing economic crime that has taken place, really this dramatic change in American society. What happened to, you know, what killed broad-based prosperity? And then we suggest that the usual suspect, the one that the economists have pointed to, can't really explain it. So we start looking for other suspects, and our candidate, and we think the evidence is actually quite convincing, is that American government has played an absolutely central role in bringing about these changes. Now, most economists have suggested, well, government's just not that important to the economy. It couldn't be responsible for these kinds of big changes. And again, we argue quite vigorously that that's not the case, and that it reflects a very narrow view of the role of government in the economy. So the first thing that we point out, and sort of the most obvious one, the most straightforward one, is that government is clearly involved in the way that it taxes. And there's been a huge change. Most people realize that there's been a change, but I think most people don't realize how dramatic the change has been. Massive cuts in the true rate of taxes that the wealthy are paying. So even as their incomes have grown dramatically, the tax rate that's applied to those incomes, the true rate of taxes that they're paying, has dropped very dramatically. And that begins in the late 1970s, even before Reagan comes into office. And, of course, Washington is now considering extending some of the Bush tax cuts for this highly favored group, even as they're, you know, saying that we need to reduce the deficit and so on.
Right.
So taxes is a significant part of the story. But government also plays a big role even before you get to the redistribution that takes place through taxes and government transfer programs. Government, we argue, helps to make markets. It's not as if markets are some state of nature that exists prior to politics or prior to government policy. And this was a point when we started writing this book, it was challenging to sometimes to get people to see the point of this argument. You know, after the financial crisis and the effect on the American economy, it's a little easier, I think, to get this basic point across, which is that government writes the rules of the road for the American economy, and how it decides to write those rules has a huge effect on how the market distributes income and wealth that is being generated. And over the course of this period, you see government, you know, quite actively rewriting the rules in area after area, with finance and issues around Wall Street being the most important. They rewrite the rules in a way that make it easier for highly concentrated economic benefits to go to those at the top of the income distribution.
And so that would be what you call policy, and then the drift part is something else.
So drift is a little more subtle, but again, I think it's really important if one wants to understand what goes on in Washington and how it affects all of us and how it affects the workings of the economy. We suggest that government isn't involved just when it rewrites the laws. It's also involved if the world is changing, the economy is changing, and government responds by doing nothing and just letting existing policy arrangements be undercut as private actors find ways to maneuver around rules that are becoming increasingly obsolete. And if one wants to tell the story of what happened to financial markets and the huge change that took place in the American economy around finance over the last generation. Part of it would be about Congress passing new deregulatory laws, but another big part of it would be this process that we call drift, where new things were starting to happen on Wall Street, and government, under intense lobbying pressure, responded by doing nothing. So just to give one quick example of that, a central instrument in the financial bubble was the development of derivatives. Warren Buffett memorably called, you know, weapons of mass destruction. And this was essentially a new financial technology, a new financial instrument that the people who had drawn up our regulatory structure in the 1930s and 1940s had no knowledge of. Derivatives didn't exist as a financial instrument in that period. So when they do become available, the question is whether or not Washington is going to exercise any regulatory oversight over these potentially quite risky financial instruments. And there were many people in Washington who said, many regulators who said, we do need to do something about this, but they were pushed back. And so that would be a classic example of what we call drift.
And all of this, according to your book, started taking place in the late 70s. Could you talk a little about how this happened?
So this is the next big part of the puzzle for us. Once we show that government and policy is really central to what happened to the American economy, the next obvious question is, well, how could that happen? How could you get a political system where you have to win a majority to win elections to pursue a set of policies that really favor a tiny slice of the American citizenry? And so that's really the core issue for the second half of the book, is to try to unpack that part of the mystery, which I think is absolutely critical if one wants to think about how we might get back to a fairer distribution of what's produced in the American economy. And you're right, we do argue that these changes really can be traced back to the 1970s. Again, even before, I think a lot of people think the big change comes when Reagan is elected in 1980, and one of the things that we demonstrate in the book is that actually a lot was already starting to happen before then. And that's part of our general view, which, again, is a little different from the conventional wisdom about politics, which mostly in the U.S. tends to focus on elections and sees elections as what drives everything in American politics. And we argue that actually whether people are organized or not is at least as important.
And the Republicans got organized.
Well, Republicans got organized, but even before Republicans got organized, business got organized.
Business got organized.
So we talk about this period in the middle of the 1970s where businesses experienced a series of setbacks in Washington, even at a time when Nixon and then Ford were in the White House. And there was a big expansion of federal regulation having to do with the environment and occupational safety and consumer protection. You know, business wasn't used to getting pushed around in Washington, and they counter-mobilized in a big way. There's a huge expansion of political action committees, of lobbying activities. The Business Roundtable, which is an organization of the nation's very largest companies, forms for the first time. The National Association of Manufacturers moves its headquarters from New York to Washington, which I think is a pretty clear indicator of where they think the action is. The Chamber of Commerce really dramatically expands. Conservative think tanks get developed and become a much more aggressive part of the Washington landscape. So over the course of the 1970s, there's a what we call an organizational revolution that goes on, with business really spearheading it.
And then at the same time, the unions, which used to fight against some of these inequities, were being decimated.
Yeah, so this is another part of the story that I think is not as well understood as it should be and is extremely important. There are a lot of liberal groups that retain strength in the 1970s and 1980s, and in some cases even become stronger. But they're not liberal groups that are organized around middle-class economic issues. They're groups that deal with environmental issues or civil rights or women's issues, but not around these core lunch pail economic concerns, which traditionally had been protected largely by organized labor. And organized labor goes into a period of very dramatic decline in the 1970s, partly because of businesses' aggressive counter-mobilization, and then a business carries that anti-labor agenda into Washington. So there's, it's both that the business side is becoming stronger, but the most organized group that is concerned with working class or middle class economic issues is also in decline.
I want to let people know again, I'm speaking with Paul Pearson, who's co-author of Winner Take All Politics, which we're talking about now. There's a lot of this really is about money. So this drift was taking place more with the Democrats. The business class was supporting Republicans, and the Democrats ended up needing money as well and then seeking it through also the business class.
Yeah, I think a useful way to think about this is that it's as if the ecology of Washington and of national politics goes through a dramatic change in the 1970s because of this shift in the balance of organized power. And this is happening at the same time that money is becoming more important in politics.
For like TV ads and stuff.
TV especially, but also the rise of polling and consultants as being central to how you run a modern campaign. So candidates and parties need money, and they're doing this against a backdrop of a really changed organizational ecology. And that affects everything in Washington. It affects both parties, though it affects them in somewhat different ways. And the way that we sum that up in the book, Jacob Hacker and I, is to say that Republicans are empowered by this change. Democrats are cross-pressured. And we spend a lot of time talking about the two parties in the book, and what we're trying to explain is that the two parties are not the same with respect to these issues. There are fundamental differences between the parties, and in some ways, the differences become even wider after the 1970s because the Republican Party becomes so radicalized, in part as a result of the new opportunities that the rise of business power makes possible for them. But Republicans initially gain a lot organizationally from these changes because it's very easy for them to raise the money they need in this climate. Democrats are not empowered. They're cross-pressured because traditionally they've worked hard at trying to speak for working class and middle-income citizens. But they now need to be able to compete in this new environment, and so they adapt as well. And an important part of the story that we tell about the 1980s and the 1990s and the last decade is one in which Democrats increasingly cater to concerns of the most prosperous Americans as they attempt to compete in this new political ecology in which you've got to raise huge amounts of cash.
And two other parts of this before we can get into what do we do about it are the media hasn't really helped much with this, and the structure of our government itself seems to be kind of a problem because it allows for gridlock and all that kind of thing.
Well, those are both really important parts of the story, Stephanie, and they would require some time to really unpack. But let me just say a couple of things. One is that we do think that the tendency of the political system towards gridlock is a really important part of the story. And the rise of the filibuster, which most people don't realize, is a new development in terms of the regularity with which it's used. It didn't used to be the case that it required 60 votes in the Senate to pass anything, but now that is the case. And in a world in which the economy is changing, that makes it very, very hard for government to keep up and to update policies. So it's part of why what we call drift has been such an important part of the story. And it's why, you know, on our list of things that we really need to think about reforming, the United States Senate would be very prominent on that list. It's just a burial ground for progressive politics, or for politics that is really responsive to the middle class. The media, I think the way that we would put it is that voters are at an enormous disadvantage in dealing with the complex, difficult, often low-profile issues that get dealt with in Washington, and that they really need organization or reliable sources of information to keep track and to be able to hold the political system accountable. And I'm not sure, I don't know whether I would say that the media is worse at this job than it was 30 years ago. It would be hard to measure that. But what I would say is that we now have very few substitutes for the media because, as I said, the sort of middle-class organizations, not just unions, but also various voluntary associations that people used to participate in, and Robert Putnam has written about this in a famous book, Bowling Alone, in which he talks about the decline of these voluntary associations, which often used to provide people with a fair amount of information or at least cues about what politicians were looking after their economic interests. And all of that is gone. And so we maybe lean on the media harder now for our information about politics, and for a variety of reasons, the media is not all that well equipped to play this role.
Okay, 2 minutes. What do we do about it?
Well, the first thing I would say is that the good news in this tough story is that this kind of top-end inequality that we've experienced is not inevitable. The economists, you know, basically told us that it was just the new reality that we had to get used to. But if it's really being generated to a large extent through politics and policy, then that's at least something that is potentially under our control. We don't have to just accept it and get used to it. So the challenge is to change the politics. And the central argument of our book is that has to be done through organization. That has to be done through organization that allows ordinary citizens to really grasp the economic stakes that are involved in Washington and put relentless pressure on politicians to do the right thing. Now, that is not something that is going to change overnight, but if one goes back, as we do in the book, to compare the contemporary period with the progressive era, when we faced many of the same challenges. Basically, the wealthy had captured politics, and the rest of society was racing to try to catch up and to put politics back into a more balanced, more equitable framework. It took decades to achieve those kinds of reforms. But having an understanding of exactly what has happened and the necessity of organizing around economic issues to combat it seems to us the most important first step.
Yeah, it's a lot of like, you know, if you forget history, you're lost kind of thing.
Right.
I think it's really fantastic, this book. I want everybody to read it. I've been speaking with Paul Pearson, who is a political science down in Berkeley, and he wrote a book called Winner Take All Politics, and with a fellow named Jacob Hacker. And this is Stephanie Potter. We're with Political Perspectives here on KBOO Portland. And Paul, I really want to thank you for writing the book and for being on this show.
Thanks so much for having me on, Stephanie.
Okay, thanks.